Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Okay, one more word from Jay Powell on the program today. Just one, we promise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today. This one is the 2nd of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We spent a bit of time yesterday reviewing Fed Chair Jay Powell's syntax during his post-meeting press conference in describing this economy and interest rates and where the central bank thinks things are going. Jay Powell, in exactly five words that he kept on using. Here's another one that was a close sixth on our list, resilient, as in economic growth and the labor market have been resilient, have held up surprisingly well in the face of the Fed's efforts to slow things down. Powell keeps using that word, but does it mean what he thinks it means? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Fed Chair Powell said this in his prepared statement yesterday.
We are attentive to recent data showing the resilience of economic growth and demand for labor. Evidence of growth persistently above potential, or that tightness in the labor market is no longer easing, could put further progress on inflation at risk.
Powell is warning that the economy might be too resilient as the Fed tries to slow things down to fight inflation.
It's a good question. You know, it's like resilient. How is this a bad thing?
Former Fed economist Claudia Sahm says consumers have kept on spending in the face of soaring prices and interest rates, which should have slammed their pocketbooks. Instead, they're driving economic growth.
And this is where the good news can become bad news, in that if consumers are still spending, well, businesses can keep raising prices. In the labor market, if there's all these job options, businesses are going to have to pay higher wages to get people back.
Powell's use of the word resilient caught the attention of economist Gary Hoover at Tulane University. He wondered if the Fed chair really meant
resistant as opposed to resilient, resistant to our old models.
Namely, fighting inflation by making it more expensive to borrow and hire workers. Instead, he says inflation is coming down without an economic contraction.
It is resilient. We have such a robust economy. Despite what's happening with monetary policy, we're going to be able to get through this thing rather spectacularly.
And here's where the confusion with resiliency lies. It's ambiguous, says economist Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union.
Resilience plays a dual role. If it was resilient when it was contributing to inflation, it was a bad thing.
But
right now, I think it is an unambiguously good thing, in that a soft landing is likely, certainly in the next year.
Now, Frick doesn't expect Fed Chair Powell to say that outright.
He always has to sound a note of caution. That's what Fed chairmen and chairwomen do.
But we can all still get a little excited to be living in a resilient economy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, two other words for you. Financial and conditions. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
We'll be right back.
California has more registered electric cars than any other state. Not surprising, perhaps. California, climate awareness, it kind of follows, right? In fact, last quarter, one in four new vehicles sold here was electric. One in four. But that also means three times as many Californians who bought new vehicles stuck with gas. Why? Well, it depends on what zip code you live in and, related, how much money you have. KCRW's Kaylee Wells talked to EV drivers about why they made the switch, and to gas-powered drivers, too, about why they didn't.
For a lot of people above a certain income threshold, becoming an EV driver is kind of a no-brainer. That's how it was for Joey Gill, who's owned his Tesla for 5 years.
I've always been like an early adopter and a bit of a techie, and once I test drove it, it was just really nice.
Most of those new EVs are parked in front of households with high incomes, like in West LA. That's where Gill works with Plasma as a research scientist. So why do EV drivers like him drive EVs? A couple of things. One, says Gill.
So we do care about, reducing carbon footprint.
He's concerned about climate change. The other big reason? EVs are cheaper to drive. If drivers can get past the high price tag up front, EVs tend to save them money in the long run on gas and maintenance.
Definitely the financial piece was a motivator.
In 2021, Tiffany Gage went all in on electric. She replaced her family's two gas vehicles with Teslas. That's partly because the gas bill was so high with her husband's 100-mile daily commute.
The fact that, like, my husband was commuting, it only made sense that we go electric because we'd be spending $10,000+ in gas a year.
But both Tiffany Gage and Joey Gill own their houses. They installed EV chargers at home and even put solar panels on their roofs to make charging their cars more affordable. But LA neighborhoods that have low EV adoption rates tend to have more renters, and often they can't charge at home. Plus, those places tend to have fewer public car chargers. Take Anna Menny, who used to work for the city of Carson in South LA County. She says she's sticking with her gas-powered Toyota Camry because in her city, it's more convenient.
I can go around every single block and find a gas station. I can't find charging stations.
There is money set aside in the Inflation Reduction Act to help pay for more, but it'll take a while for those federal dollars to get to the local level and for those chargers to come online. Menny also mentioned another big barrier. The sticker price of an EV is typically higher.
What they deem affordable electric vehicles, they're starting at the $30,000 range.
Combine that with interest rates at the highest they've been in 15 years, it's just not doable for a lot of car buyers. California does have a program to help low-income drivers buy an EV, but the funding is almost dried up, and there's a wait list for what little money is left. Plus, even if affording the EV and finding a charger near home isn't a problem, the last big barrier is as old as EVs themselves.
Range anxiety, that is the correct term.
Susan Lowry of Lancaster, California, worries that she'll get stranded. She's retired and loves to go camping in her gas-powered Ford F-150. One of her favorite drives is some 400 desolate miles from Tahoe to Utah.
Stunningly beautiful.
It's even called the loneliest road in America. And even though new EVs can go much farther on a single charge than they did early on, Lowry is skeptical.
We don't go places where things are easily found. I mean, next summer's big trip is going to be to Alaska.
The Inflation Reduction Act includes money set aside to put more universal car chargers in rural and low-income areas. Even if that takes a while, Lowry says she knows she should make the switch and thinks it's the right thing to do.
It's all about sacrifice.
And if she has to give up one of her favorite drives on a lonely road through Nevada, Lowry says she's willing to do that. In Los Angeles, I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
With home prices where they are, high, and mortgage rates where they are, also high, consider this. Zillow did some number crunching and figured out it would take the typical home buyer about 13 and a half years to break even. And therein lies the reason, one of the reasons, that fewer people are buying homes right now. Mindy Palmer is one of the real estate agents we talk to from time to time. She's with Berkshire Hathaway Montana Properties in Missoula, Montana.
In my scope of things. I'm just tiptoeing into my 26th year full-time in this market, and it's almost a bit unnerving how remarkably quiet the market is right now. I attribute it all solely to those stinking interest rates. One of the major factors that we're seeing in our marketplace right now are out-of-state buyers making contingency offers on property here. By contingency, I mean that it's contingent upon them, that buyer, selling their property in XYZ state. In some cases, they could have a buyer that has to sell their property in order to pursue theirs. So it becomes a real domino effect. That is definitely a big segment of the market. They want to move here. They just can't get their places sold where they're living. Prices have expanded, risen, soared. Take your pick. I run into people every day asking me about the real estate market in general. And gosh, my house is worth a fortune. And boy, I'd love to sell it, but I don't have anywhere to go. And that is very true. When you can't afford to replace your own setup, you might as well sit tight. My own business, I'm still doing the same numbers, but half the amount of transactions. And you know, while I'm used to the frenetic pace of 30, 40 contracts a year, I've welcomed the breathability of this pace. I'm enjoying being able to take midweek hikes.
Mindy Palmer, hiking and selling houses when she can in Missoula, Montana. You can tell us your real estate story, your housing story, whatever story you like, actually. Marketplace.org is where you do that. Coming up.
These days, I don't know if anybody's really making them anymore.
The end of an era, perhaps. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it is the really happy music today. Dow Industrial is up 564 points, 1.7%, 33,839. The NASDAQ lifted 232 points, that's 1.8% there, closed at 13,294. The S&P 500 added 79 points, about 1.9%, and things at 43.17. Hey, listen, have you started your holiday shopping yet? Apparently, there is a significant number of people who can confidently answer yes to that question. Who are you people? Anyway, data is from the National Retail Federation. 43% of the shoppers they surveyed said they started their holiday shopping before November. Again, who are you people? Consumers also said they're planning to spend an average of $875 on gifts, decorations, and food this holiday season. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We probably should have put this before the numbers, but we do like to spread the macroeconomic stuff out across the program. It makes it easier to digest, we believe. I mentioned financial conditions up at the top of the program. Well, here's why. It's possible, it's likely even, that what's been happening in the bond market, yields going up, as we've been telling you, it's possible that those tighter financial conditions might actually take pressure off the Fed to raise or even keep rates elevated for as long as they've been saying it. Powell was asked about it yesterday.
In this case, the tighter financial conditions we're seeing from higher long-term rates, but also from other sources like the stronger dollar and lower equity prices, could matter for future rate decisions as long as two conditions are satisfied.
Condition number one.
The first is that the tighter conditions would need to be persistent. And that is something that remains to be seen.
And two.
The second thing is that the longer-term rates that have moved up, they can't simply be a reflection of expected policy moves from us that we would then, that if we didn't follow through on them, then the rates would come back down.
I actually think those are the same thing, right? Both of those things, for tighter financial conditions to take pressure off the Fed, longer-term bond yields, the 10-year that we talk about all the time, it has to stay higher for longer. Now, here is why I went through all of that. Today, the bond market looked at what Powell said yesterday and said, yeah, no. The yield on the 10-year fell back down to 4.6%. It was at 5 a week ago. Also, as I said, stock prices today boomed. So, looser financial conditions. According to the National Weather Service, its National Data Buoy Center, should you be curious, the winds off Virginia Beach, Virginia today are out of the east-northeast at 5 knots, gusting to 10 tomorrow and Saturday. That's of interest because there is news of the offshore wind economy. The Biden administration has approved another big wind farm set to be built off the coast of Virginia Beach, the fifth such commercial-scale project the administration has approved as it shoots to get 30 gigawatts of offshore wind energy up and running by 2030. All is not smooth sailing, though, if I can mix my metaphors. Financial and logistical challenges abound with these offshore projects even after they've gotten federal approval. Case in point, Ørsted, which is a major wind developer, said this week it's pulling out of two projects that it's been planning off the coast of New Jersey. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
When the pandemic started, Abe Silverman was about to redo his kitchen.
And you know what? When those prices started going up, we stepped back and the contractor stepped back.
Silverman at Columbia's Center on Global Energy Policy says that's effectively what happened with Ørsted pulling out of those two big wind projects off the coast of New Jersey. The company had bid on them before the pandemic and the war in Ukraine caused major supply chain issues, and before prices and interest rates started to rise. Now it's decided the math doesn't work anymore.
The problem is building these projects. They're very, very expensive. Almost all big clean energy projects are capital intensive.
David Victor at the University of California, San Diego, says building offshore wind projects in particular also takes a long time, which means a lot can change this time around.
Two things have changed. One is that siting has proved more challenging. Siting interconnection with the grid, that delays these projects. The other thing, much more important, is that interest rates have gone up.
And it's all just become much more expensive. But inflation, interest rates, and supply chain issues aside, Chris Olith at the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind says offshore wind is also just harder to build and connect to the grid than other renewables, at least right now.
And that is because offshore wind is a nascent industry here in the United States. It's still a relatively new technology, and therefore the supply chain is very new. The interconnection concepts are very new. We don't have a well-heeled permitting structure and regulatory regime.
Solar and onshore wind, meanwhile, have been around longer and have already worked through more of those growing pains. Abe Silverman at Columbia says he thinks offshore wind will, too, in time, and that the economic factors at play now won't always be a barrier.
I think there's a strong case to be made that this is a blip that will, you know, not necessarily dim the long-term prospects for offshore wind.
Partly, he says, because it will be hard for the U.S. to decarbonize without it. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
not officially a strike or a work stoppage or anything else resembling traditional organized labor, which has had so much success this year. But pharmacists at retail drug chains have had about enough and want people to know about it. The social media hashtag is Pharmageddon, as some pharmacists at retail pharmacies have walked off the job this week. CVS and Walgreens say disruptions were minor, but these walkouts do follow similar actions around the country last month, a sign of the strains in a key part of the healthcare economy. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on that one.
When pharmacist Bled Tanaway started working for a drugstore chain in 2016, she says her lean staff was already overworked. Then came the pandemic.
I could really feel a shift within my team.
On top of filling prescriptions, Tanaway and her coworkers were running a busy vaccine clinic. She says she asked her supervisor for a break on prescription quotas and other corporate performance metrics.
And the answer was no. You are still expecting to perform like you are supposed to perform.
Already burned out, Tanaway believes the pressure led her to make a mistake. In 2021, she quit.
And for me, that was my breaking point, because I could not stay there and put my patient in danger.
Tanaway now works at a hospital in Oklahoma City, but she still helped organize this week's retail pharmacist walkouts. Anandi Law, with the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, says persistent understaffing and profit-driven performance quotas at these chains mean worse patient counseling.
There's constantly this at our back saying, fill more, get those prescriptions out. But we are not able to dedicate that time, much needed time, for our patients.
Law says part of the solution is increased staffing at retail pharmacies. But chains like CVS and Walgreens say filling open positions is tough. Richard Dang, a professor of clinical pharmacy at USC, says there's actually no shortage of pharmacists looking for work.
However, there are many graduates and many individuals in the profession who are hesitant to work in a chain setting where they don't feel supported.
That's why many of his students look for work in clinical settings after as many as 7 years of schooling. Dang says most retail pharmacists don't belong to a union, but these recent walkouts could lead to more interest in organizing. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Apple had another product launch this week, zippier chips, better, faster MacBooks. You've probably seen the coverage because Apple. In September, though, the company made arguably a more significant move. It discontinued the iPhone Mini, the last of its distinctly small devices on the market. And this is kind of a trend. Gone are the days of the BlackBerry and the flip phone that easily slid into your back pocket. Today, phones are just bigger. And where, oh, where do you suppose all the good small phones have gone? Sean Hollister is a senior editor at The Verge who wrote about his hunt for a small phone. Sean, welcome to the program.
So good to be here.
So you go on this journey for a smaller phone. What did you find?
Well, I went out looking on Google to see if I could find guides to the phone I should buy after my iPhone 13 mini, because I do love the small one-headed phones. And all the guides that I found on the internet were directing me to phones that were not only just a little bit bigger, but much bigger.
So let me just say I'm with you on the whole phone thing. I have average size hands, as you do in this piece, and I have to do that whole one-handed keyboard thing so my thumb can reach and that whole deal. But before we get into the results of your search, why do you think they are so hard to find now?
What I've been told by companies, by carriers, is that people just want bigger phones with big, beautiful screens. But what I've found every time I've gone looking is that consumers were never really given a choice. Mm-hmm. When we migrated away from QWERTY keyboards on phones, you know, to the first iPhones and mm-hmm. Galaxy Nexus phones that made use of touchscreens instead, there wasn't really a time period in there where they said, we're going to bring out a flagship keyboard phone and a flagship touchscreen phone and let consumers choose. They just migrated all the way to the big screen phones. Similarly, with the iPhone Mini was just one possibility out of a market of usually much larger phones than that.
Well, so who still is making, in your mind, what let me ask you first, what constitutes a good small phone? And then let me ask you, who's making them?
The most important thing to know is that screen size is not phone size. If somebody says, I have a 4.7-inch phone to sell you, they mean that the screen is 4.7 inches diagonally, but the actual phone might be a good bit larger than that. Today's standard phone is about 6 inches tall and about 3 inches wide. And so you got to stretch wider, you got to stretch taller. It's just much more difficult to manage in one hand.
So who's making them?
These days, I don't know if anybody's really making them anymore. Sony used to sell a phone called the Xperia Compact. These days, their phones are much bigger than that. Even folding flip phones. I have a Samsung Galaxy Flip right now in front of me. They're smaller to put in your pocket because they fold down into like a pocket square when they're closed. But open, they're as big as an iPhone 15 Pro Max. They're as big as the biggest phones out there.
I wonder if you realize that your quest here is a little bit quixotic, right? That it's always going to be bigger is better, and I want more pixels and a bigger screen, and I don't care if I have to use two hands to do it.
Oh, I think I do at this point. That's why back in the physical keyboard days, I was like, I'm going to ride or die with this Droid 4. And I rode and I died. I mean, the phone gave up on me. And so this time I'm not sticking with that. I'm moving on. I've got my Galaxy Flip phone, and we're going to see how it works out.
Well, best of luck to you. Sean Hollister, senior editor at The Verge, talking about phone size. I'm with you, Sean.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, we try not to do math on this program, but the macroeconomic formula of the day on this Thursday is widgets produced per hour worked. The answer gets you worker productivity in this economy, which we learned this morning rose at an annualized rate of 4.7% in the third quarter. Productivity growth, among other things, means labor costs companies less per unit of goods sold, which then can keep inflationary pressures in check. All right, we are out of here. One more moment of economic context, though. It's from the Looser Financial Conditions file. Think back to what I was saying about Powell. Freddie Mac said today the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage fell for the first time in almost 2 months. It's still high, 7.76%, but, you know, lower. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.